Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. What a joy to gather with you here today. Thank you for joining me. You can always give me your feedback either by text message at 877-933-2484 or via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Love to hear from listeners like you. And so today on Connecting Faith, which you guys know that every day what we're seeking to do is reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, seeking to be equipped for the conversations of our day where you and I can actually enter into sort of the headline news and bring the mind of Christ to bear, certainly always in ways that honor Jesus. Like, that's our goal. So that's what we're here to do. Thank you for joining me in that effort. It's important work, and it's more fun if we do it together. So I'm going to lead off today probably with a story some of you are thinking we circle around to too often. But until he comes home, I'm going to keep pounding on the door of heaven, and I hope that the U.S. State Department and the President of the United States and Vice President and anybody else who has the power to pound on the door, the diplomacy door in Turkey, would keep pounding on the door on behalf of imprisoned Pastor Andrew Brunson. So I have an update on that story today. If you are a person who follows the financial news, you would be reading this story today in the Financial Times, which is one of the leading papers in Great Britain. If you are a person who follows sort of the Christian news cycle, then you would be seeing this story today from CNS, which is Christian News Service. If you are a person who, you just follow the breaking news however it comes, you might see this today in the Wall Street Journal. So the headline in the Wall Street Journal is "Hopes Rise for Release of U.S. Pastor Being Held in Turkey." Andrew Brunson appears in court on October the 12th, where a judge could decide to free him. And so let me read the lead in the Wall Street Journal article, and then we'll circle back around to what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said at the Value Voters Summit on Friday, and how the Turkish people are responding today, or actually markets are responding, in terms of the value of the Turkish lira in anticipation that, in fact, Turkey and the United States might come to a place of agreement and Andrew Brunson might be released from prison in Turkey and get to come home. Should all that come to pass between now or on October the 12th, I will tell you there will be much rejoicing, not only in heaven, but there will be much rejoicing in Black Mountain, North Carolina, at Andrew's home church. There will be much rejoicing in his home denomination of the EPC, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, and there will certainly be much rejoicing by his wife, Noreen, and their children, and his parents. I mean, everybody who knows him and loves him. Okay, here's the lead in the Wall Street Journal. Turkish authorities are sending signals that an American pastor facing terrorism charges could be released next month, raising fresh hopes in the United States that the polarizing dispute will soon be resolved. And here's what sets the stage for this. Many of you know that the United Nations meeting just resumed this morning in New York City. You know that President Erdogan and President Trump are both in attendance. Here's what I would say. You know, we should hesitate if we think that they're going to get together and have a meeting, although that is actually apparently what the Turks are suggesting to their people, because that's what the Financial Times leads with. So here's the lead in the Financial Times, the headline being "Turkish Lira Rallies on U.S. Pastor Breakthrough Hopes." Turkey and the United States are likely to hold talks this week on the fate of a detained American pastor at the center of a diplomatic dispute, a senior official said on Monday. That would be a senior Turkish official, because no senior United States officials are saying anything like that. News that sent the country's lira sharply higher. You'll remember that the lira utterly collapsed when the United States began putting very stiff sanctions on Turkey in relationship to their failure to release our citizen and American pastor named Andrew Brunson. For those of you who are not up to speed on this story, you can go to my website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. We actually have an Andrew Brunson page with the timeline and opportunities for you to be praying actively for him. In preparation for the October 12th hearing, Andrew Brunson's lawyer has said that he has actually received memos containing new accusations leveled by secret witnesses, codenamed Sword and Dagger, one of them alleging that Pastor Brunson transported bags of cash by boat into Syria. And like previous secret witnesses, the is expected to appear not in person where Brunson could actually face his accuser, but via a video link with their face blurred out and their voice altered. So the person would not be identified, and it would be impossible then to actually answer your accuser. So I don't actually have a huge level of confidence that this is going to happen on October the 12th. However, based on Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's very passionate speech to the Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on Friday, I have great hope that eventually this is absolutely going to come to pass. So Mike Pompeo said on Friday, in part in celebration of what he describes as far and away the greatest highlight to date of his job as Secretary of State, which was bringing home three Americans from captivity in North Korea. So you all remember that story and our celebration of it. Pompeo said that he remembered his hopes and his prayers that the three would be brought safely home. And when he saw them, this is a quote, when he saw them get out of the vehicle and he saw that they could walk and they appeared to be in relatively good health, he said, "I was not emotionally prepared for that moment." And even speaking about it, his voice cracked and trembled. And he says, "It reminds me again of the greatness of our nation." He then shared this, and I think that you all will appreciate this. Pompeo recalled that one of the men handed him an index card after he descended the stairs from the plane at Andrews Air Force Base. Pompeo slipped it into his pocket. "As I got home that night," this is what he shared on Friday at the Values Voter Summit, he said, "I was at home with Susan, and I pulled it out of my pocket, and on that index card was Psalm 126. And it reads as follows, 'When the Lord brought back the captives to Zion, we were like men who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy.'" And so Pompeo said that we need to continue to work because there are thousands of Christians and people of other faiths, not only in North Korea, but elsewhere around the world, who are praying for that kind of deliverance from captivity and from the fear of persecution, and that we as a free people must work diligently for their freedom as well. That's when he transitioned to a conversation specifically about Pastor Andrew Brunson. And he said this, and this will thrill your heart, I think, as it thrills mine. And certainly, I hope, encourage you to be praying the news today in relationship to Pastor Andrew Brunson, that with me, you would continue to knock on the door of heaven, even as obviously the Secretary of State and the President and the Vice President of this country continue to knock on the door, the diplomatic door, in Turkey. So here's what Mike Pompeo said. "Let me say right now here, we are sparing no effort to return Pastor Brunson home to the United States. The work is important. He has been wrongly held. His proper place is to be able to return here to once again practice his faith in our great nation. On the day that Pastor Brunson returns," Pompeo said, "just like the men I spoke of a bit ago, they also will be able to say that the Lord has done great things for us. And again, our hearts will be filled with joy." I hope you'll pray with me for Andrew Brunson. There is a Pray Andrew Brunson page on the EPC, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church website, if you would like to engage in prayer with that denomination for their minister member. The Black Mountain Presbyterian Church is also actively engaged as his home congregation, and many others as well. So this really encourage you to be praying with and for Andrew and his family and his release. Okay, before we take our little the break that we always have to take at this point in the show, I recognize that it would be completely remiss of me to not at least touch on what is going on with Judge Brett Kavanaugh and the ongoing questions related to what did or didn't happen when he was in high school and college, what did or didn't, what people do or do not remember, and who remembers it and who remembers what. I am simply going to say that today, you and I are actually not in a position to know. We know what we know. We know what we'd like to know. It's a question as to whether or not we can know what we might like to know before a vote needs to be taken on the matter. There are some things that we cannot know. And there are people who think that they know. And I think that that leaves us in a place as a nation that is not only highly polarized, but really conflicted about whether or not the truth of a matter actually matters to us. And so I think that the presumption of innocence is really critical and important. I obviously believe that the ability at any point in time for someone who is victimized to come forward and share their story is important. But I also think that that story has to be in some way, shape, or form verifiable. And so I think we follow the rule of law. And I think that when we talk about the credibility of a claim, it has to be something that is substantiated in some way, corroborated in some way, shape, or form. I'm not going to deal any more with that particular issue today because I think there is more to be known. And I think that within a couple of days, we're going to know more. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a school bus that became a virtual Noah's Ark in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. And we're also going to talk about Catholic bishops in China. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We're actually going to continue today with some of the headlines, bringing the mind of Christ to bear. I have one for you that I think you're going to really enjoy. I always get very positive feedback from you guys when I pick a headline, and you can actually turn right around and use it in your conversations today. And you seem to particularly like it when I actually give you the direct biblical reference. I don't make you do any work on your own. So here you go. So this is a story coming out of Hurricane Florence. It features a truck driver from Tennessee. And I love this guy's can-do spirit. He saw a need. He found a way to help. Here's basically how it unfolded. So this truck driver from, I'll describe it as Middle Tennessee, he saw on the news how numerous animal shelters had been overcrowded with lost or rescued animals, and he thought, hey, I could help. Now, remember, he's a truck driver. So he wanted to help transport animals to vacant shelters, but he knew he couldn't put them in a semi-trailer. Like, that's just, first of all, not safe. It's not climate controlled. I mean, on and on. There's lots of reasons. So he thought, well, what can I do? Now, here's a guy who's got a can-do spirit, when you ask me. He said, well, I'll just go buy a bus. So you've probably driven down the road and seen these places where, you know, sad old school buses are sitting there waiting for someone to think of a good reason to come and buy them and put them back to use. So that's what happens here. He took the seats out of the bus to make room for its new passengers. And on the side of the bus, he painted the words "Emergency Animal Rescue Shelter." And the writer of the article says he should have just written Noah's Ark. So if you can imagine the shelters in North and South Carolina being completely overrun in terms of their ability to accommodate cats and dogs whose families were fleeing the flood and couldn't take their animals with them to wherever it was that they were going to shelter for a period of time. And so this man loads that bus up with, the pictures are pretty astonishing. You can see it all at the Washington Post and other outlets. Here's what I love about the can-do spirit. I love that a person saw a need, allowed God to touch their heart, and then went out and actually made something good happen. And he's so joyful when he's retelling the tale to the Post reporter at a Waffle House on his way to Alabama, where shelters were empty and ready to receive stranded animals. And so, you know, he's talking about just simply the joy that he gets by caring for these creatures who obviously cannot care for themselves. Now, if you need help getting God back into this conversation, here's a hint for you. The passage that you're looking for is in Genesis. It's early on in the book of Genesis, and we call it the story of Noah's Ark. So you can actually go to like Genesis chapter 6 through 9, and you could read the story for yourself, get up to speed on it, and then say, hey, now I see how this story that Carmen is relating about somebody rescuing animals from a flood, I see why somebody suggested we might call that Noah's Ark. And you say to yourself, okay, Carmen, that's kind of silly. Like, it's kind of silly that you even think that we would need that interpretive key. Friends, people in the culture today do not have the Bible as a reference point for the way that they're thinking about things. And so when I said Noah's Ark at the beginning of this, your mind, if you are a student of Scripture, if you are a church-going person, your mind immediately went to the story of a man named Noah, who lived in a period of time when people were simply just conceiving of greater and greater wickedness, and God actually got to the place where he was sorry that he made us. I'll think about that. That's very tragic. And then he's got this one faithful guy. First of all, imagine being the one faithful guy in a totally unfaithful generation. I mean, that's just not true of the time in which we live. So never despair that things couldn't be worse, because things could always be worse. We could be living in days like the days of Noah, and which would mean there'd be no Christian radio, and there would certainly be nobody agreeing with you that things needed to change. You'd be it. Like, you'd be the one person. It's an incredibly, incredibly tragic story of loneliness in the midst of a fallen world. So that's Noah. We got Noah, the one faithful guy, the one guy whose heart is still turned toward God. And God says to Noah, as the song goes, and then some of you could now sing along with me. This is my favorite sing-along with my granddaughter, Emma. God said to Noah to build him an arky-arky. God said to, I promised I would never sing on this show, but I can't help it. Noah gets on the project of building God an ark, and then he does really what is the most remarkable part of this. He loads it up. Now, they came two by two, right? Okay, have you read it closely recently? Because some of them, there's more than two by two. So you need to go and reread it, because some of the animals come on in parties of six. So there you go. Why am I lifting this up today? Because there are very, very practical ways that the Bible applies to life. And there are very practical conversations that you and I can get into about the days of Noah and what it must have been like to live in a time, in a generation, where people just conceived of greater and greater evil all the time. And then to be able to reflect with our neighbors and our friends that we need to be conscientiously focused on the good, the beautiful, and the true in order that our generation would not move in that kind of direction, that we would actually move in a more positive direction, in a redemptive direction. We know what the values of the kingdom of God are. We know what the principles of the kingdom of heaven are. Jesus has revealed them to us. And so you and I need to be ambassadors of those kingdom principles and those kingdom ideals in the world in which we now live. Okay, and also then let's continue to pray the news. Apparently this afternoon, there are some communities in coastal South Carolina where rivers will now crest. And so the water is still rising in relationship to Hurricane Florence. So let's continue to be praying in relationship to that. And obviously, if you're in a position to help, please do so. All right, one more quick thing here. In this half, one more news item, and that is a news item out of China, and it's in relationship to the Roman Catholic Church. This is actually a story that has been developing over a long period of time. I don't think that this action is a particular surprise to Roman Catholics, but it might be a surprise to those who imagine that the Roman Catholic Church, via the Pope at the Vatican, would never bow the knee to a communist authoritarian government. And yet in this case, they have. So I think that the questions raised here are, by whose authority are the leaders of the church selected? Who gets to appoint church leaders? Who gets to decide who leads the church of Jesus Christ? Now, one would imagine that the answer to that question is, the church. But in this case, the answer is communist China. Now, in my opinion, this is not, as it's described by the Vatican, an outreach. This is basically capitulation. So let me read a couple of excerpts from the story, because it's can be found in the New York Times, and that's going to have a paywall in your way if you if you're not a subscriber. So let me just read a couple of paragraphs to you. It says the Vatican said Saturday that it had reached a provisional deal with the Chinese government to end a decades-old power struggle over the right to appoint bishops in China. It was the communist country's first formal recognition of the Pope's authority within the Roman Catholic Church in the world's most populous nation. Under the deal, Pope Francis recognized the legitimacy of seven bishops who had been appointed by the Chinese government. Now, these seven bishops had previously been excommunicated because they were not selected by the Vatican. So the Vatican says that this agreement is in keeping with the Pope's outreach to parts of the world where he hopes to increase the church's presence and spread of its message. Critics obviously do not want to see the church share its authority with an authoritarian government, and believe that this agreement represents a retreat, setting up a dangerous precedent for future relations in other authoritarian countries. And so I lift this up to you because the church is like on fire, radically growing in China. And for that, we need to give God thanks and praise. The Catholics wanted in on that. I mean, I think that's essentially what's going on here, because Protestant congregations, evangelical congregations, are literally growing like wildfire in China. And you and I both know that they're also under great persecution. Well, if you get into an agreement with the Chinese government about who can lead those churches, that these are, you know, actually like people that they picked to be the bishops of your church, then in all likelihood, they are going to allow those churches to, I don't know what the word would be, function. Whether or not they'll flourish is a whole other question. And so when you have the Chinese government on the one hand burning down churches and telling people that it's illegal for them to take their children to Sunday school, and then on the other hand, you have them entering into an agreement with the Vatican about particular bishops who are going to be authorized to serve, you actually, I mean, in my view, you have a fracture in the body of Christ that's actually being exacerbated by a secular authoritarian, in this case, communist regime. So I obviously, not keeping my opinion very veiled here, I obviously think this is a bad move. And so let's be, you know, obviously you want to pray for the flourishing of the church in every place at every time. I just want to simply lift up to you that I think that capitulating to a communist regime in this case is maybe not the most helpful way forward for the flourishing of the church. Okay, friends, I got to take a quick break. Next up on Connecting Faith, I'm going to be talking with, this is going to surprise you, the architect of Common Core. He's also the CEO of the College Board. Why am I talking with him as a liberal? Well, because he actually appreciates the contributions of Christian higher ed in today's marketplace of ideas, and he's going to talk with us about it. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. I know your love won't leave, so I won't worry, because if I fall, I win every time I get up. Hey, friends, welcome back. I am thrilled to be joined today by the CEO of the College Board. His name is David Coleman. David, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So I'm sure this is happening in households across the country, but at my house, there is a current study underway for the PSAT. You guys oversee the SAT and AP exams. And why don't you share with folks, you know, sort of in layman's terms, what is the College Board and why does it matter if, like, you know, I've got a seventh grader and a sophomore in high school?
Sounds great. College Board is a membership institution, meaning we're composed really of the nation's colleges and high schools working together. But we sponsor the advanced placement exams as well as the SAT. And in candor, Carmen, those are not words that fill kids with a sense of ease and confidence. They often are a source of a lot of anxiety. So I hope by talking to me directly, the president of the College Board, I might offer a few things that would offer a sense of ease and confidence in young people, whether they're a sophomore about to take an exam or a seventh grader looking forward to it. So let me just give you a couple things, and then we can go deeper if it's useful. One is the best preparation for the SAT is now absolutely free. It was never fair that some people had access to expensive test prep but others didn't. So we partnered with Khan Academy to provide free test prep for the world, and it's personalized. So when your, I wasn't sure whether you said your daughter or son is preparing for the SAT, for the PSAT, they can use that. And when they get back their score, they get a personalized account on Khan Academy that will further respond to their own needs if he or she chooses to sign up for it. If you're from a low-income family, you get a waiver to not only take the SAT, but to take it again. And then once you take it, you'll get 4 fee waivers to apply to college. So we've done a lot to expand, to make sure that if you don't have means, that this doesn't get in your way. And finally, we've done a lot to slow down the tests themselves. There's now 45% more time per question on the new SAT than any admissions exam. And in advanced placement exams, there are far fewer questions, giving students more time. Because I think one of the worst things the testing industry has done is to confuse quick and smart, and some of our deepest thinkers may be slower. And I just want kids to really relax and know that we're doing our best to find their strengths and give them the time and space to do their best work.
Okay, I think that's just going to be hugely encouraging to people, David. And friends, let me share with you that if you go to qideas.org and you look for David Coleman's Q Ideas talk, it's entitled Patient Pluralism, which doesn't really give away, in my view, this part of the conversation that we're having now. But all of the things that he just talked about are highlighted in there as well. And so for those of you who really want an introduction to this material, it's just great. So that's David Coleman's Q Ideas talk. And just really fantastic. Hey, while we're on that subject, let's just talk a little bit about patient pluralism. What is it and why does it matter?
You know, thanks for pointing the Q Ideas talk, because there I put forward the idea that those people like me who lead, you know, what you call secular education organizations, something like the College Board, have to do so much more to engage with the religious community and education at every level. So I know you know that I'm known for playing a major role in the Common Core. And what I learned from that experience, Carmen, is that I needed to do so much better to engage the religious community, whether that's the homeschooling community, the independent schools, the Christian independent schools or Catholic schools, other religious school leaders, far earlier in the process in a shaping way. And since I became the CEO of the College Board, one of the first things I did was convened a group of religious scholars to talk about reading at that great evangelical college in Illinois. And then when we redesigned the SAT, I met with leaders from the homeschooling community and elsewhere to make sure that whatever body of standards their kids were learning, that they were focused on, the SAT would fairly measure the good work that they were doing. And what I've come to from all of this is to believe that patient pluralism asks us not only, a leader like me, to engage with the religious community in education, but to learn from it. So you may know the first opinion piece I wrote as president of the College Board was a defense of Wheaton College and Christian colleges who are facing threats of their accreditation being removed. And I found through my encounters with the community of faith that they not only deserve to be defended, but had rich gifts to offer secular education institutions, whether those are colleges or schools. And so I think patient pluralism means at its deepest, learning from one another and finding gifts in each other's work and celebrating that diversity rather than trying to shut it down.
Okay, friends, and if you want to read David's piece, it's posted at Christianity Today. It was published back in May, and it's entitled College Board CEO, How Religious Education Helps Us Rethink the College Admissions Race. The soul craft found in faith-based learning is just what higher ed needs now. So, David, let's turn there. Let's talk about education as soul craft. What does that mean? How does that differ from the approach that many institutions take?
I think so often we talk about education as if it could be summed up as merely readiness for college or readiness for a career, and ignore the fact that everything's at stake in how we educate young people, their character, their sense of themselves. So I'll give you some specific examples. And to me, these are the kinds of gifts that religious educators know and have to share with everyone. You know, in my own family, we keep the Sabbath holy, and we understand that the idea that there is a period of solitude and a period of reflection each week is essential to any great work you do. So that religious institutions and homeschooling environments have more of a place where kids learn the power of solitude and what's seeable only through being alone, and that's essential for education. You might talk about gratitude and grace, that the idea that young people grow up with a sense of owning their own achievement and striving hard, but also understanding the limits of their power. This kind of idea is powerful when they go on to college and everywhere because they're much more resilient. They're much more able to face the setbacks in their lives if they understand their role in their lives, but also their own limits. You might look at another beautiful thing is what books do we read that we read together? The university in America, university used to mean that you went to college in part to read some books that we would all know in common. Think of the founding documents of this country. Of course, that meant the Bible at one point. But you can't have the great debate in the university between faith and reason and about the texture of what you're reading if people have not read the Bible in common, if people have not read the founding documents in common. So I think what the university lost was the soul of the matter when we lost books read in common, when we lost shared things that are part of your history as a learner, and those include centrally the Bible, things like the founding documents in this country.
Okay, again, friends, I'm having what I think many of you will regard as a surprising conversation with the president of the College Board. His name is David Coleman. David, do you have a preferred social media where people can find you?
You know, that's a great question. We're actually working here at the College Board on my choice, Carmen. So to be more open, I've tried to avoid the social media landscape so far, and we have a general College Board moniker. But I do feel the misunderstandings are growing so large that it's time for me to get on Twitter and to share my voice more openly. So you catch me at a very interesting point because I was tempted to leave Facebook and Twitter to an earlier generation, but I've come to think that too much misunderstanding arises. So you can see my Q Ideas speech at Q Ideas. The College Board retweets some of my work. But I think that with encouragement from people like you, I am thinking actually of stepping forward to clear the waters a bit and make sure, for example, that our engagement with the community of faith is more widely known. And what's nice is you can talk to those people as well. So, for example, I was on Cardinal Dolan's radio show here in New York City, the Cardinal, of course, of New York. And I've been very active with the homeschooling community and that great community of learners. And they've published and written about that. And they do, by the way, extremely well on the SAT if you're interested. And that would be unsurprising to you. I aim to advocate, as long as I'm in this position, that we need to do so much more to honor education that happens in the home, that happens in religious schools, and widen the focus of our lens.
Well, I know that your message today is certainly resonating with our listeners here on Connecting Faith. So, friends, if you communicate with me, I will be sure that whatever you communicate gets communicated to David. How that sounds like a deal. So you guys can email me at carmen@myfaithradio.com. You know to follow me on Twitter, @CarmenLaBerge. And David's work is retweeted by @CollegeBoard. Okay, David, one more question, because I'd really like for you to just kind of survey for us what you see in the higher ed landscape today. We've had conversations here about the restriction of speech. We've had conversations here about all kinds of things, threats to academic freedom, sort of the social media mob mentality we see some places. Tell us what you see when you survey the higher ed landscape today.
I'm in a state of high concern when I survey the higher education landscape about the health of the discussions that are happening there. And typically, Carmen, I try to figure out something productive to do about it. So here's what we are going to announce, and I'll give it a bit of a, before it's full public announcement, share it with your listeners, and maybe you'll get some reactions. I think that before students are ready to go to college, they need a working knowledge of the First Amendment of this country. And they need to understand that the First Amendment does not just include the right to a free press or the right to assemble, but it crucially involves the free exercise of religion. that our founder's intent was to create a society in which all those things could flourish together, that we could honor one another's faith and our ability to share our views in a healthy environment. The First Amendment demands that of us. So we, with the Constitution Center, are sponsoring for all advanced placement students a two-week course after their advanced placement course is over, focusing on understanding the First Amendment, the five freedoms that it enshrines, as a way of getting them ready. We almost assume young people will be ready to participate in college and understand what healthy interactions look like. And in my mind, one of the best things we can do is immerse those students in the First Amendment before they go to college.
All right, that is thrilling. That thrills my heart. You couldn't have talked about something that would get me more excited or on board.
So
I'll look forward to that something that you're doing in cooperation with the Constitution Center. I look forward to AP students across the country engaging with the First Amendment and really knowing what it is, its breadth and depth, before they go onto college campuses, because that's going to be the fastest way to impact the campus, right? You'll have these new freshmen arriving, and they're going to be looking at these upperclassmen, and they're going to be saying, dudes, you clearly do not know the First Amendment. Like, that's going to be great. That's the fastest way to influence what happens on campus. I love that.
That's our hope.
All right. Well, David, that makes you seem like a really smart guy. So there you go. That's a fantastic thing.
No, I'm delighted to share it. And I really do think that, and for them to know the texture of the First Amendment, you know, it's not just one freedom there. You know, it's at least five. It's the abridgment of freedom of speech and or the press, or the right of people to assemble, to petition the government, or address their grievances. I know you know this by heart, but we don't need a comic book version. We need the real thing.
Yeah, amen. Amen. You are preaching to the choir here. Hey, friends, his name is David Coleman. I highly recommend you check out his Q Ideas talk. Also, you can grab the article from Christianity Today, College Board CEO, How Religious Education Helps Us Rethink the College Admissions Race. And we are going to look forward with great anticipation to this cooperative effort with the Constitution Center on the First Amendment. David Coleman, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
And thank you for your time and for your work. Thanks a million.
All right. Hey, friends, that was thrilling. When we come back, we're going to be making the connecting point. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. If you can take, then you can give. Learn how to love and you learn how to live. It's never a waste of time or money to put your heart on the line for somebody. Learning to love, we're still learning to love. I said it's never a waste of time or money to put your heart on the line for somebody. I'm learning to love. Anybody can break your heart, but it takes someone to love it.
Hey friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Sorry we're having a little bit of a technical difficulty, so I'm coming to you by a different method right at this minute. We're going to make the connecting point, and I came across an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal entitled Why the Left is Consumed with Hate. And it's an interesting piece, and it illuminates some things that I have been observing in terms of the approach that people on the left seem to take in terms of everything. And so we're not just dealing with sort of an outrage climate. We're actually dealing with a very seemingly deep-seated hate. And so the article asks the question, like, when did hatred actually begin to emerge on the American left? And sort of recognizing that it's kind of counterintuitive that those on the left would view themselves as being completely without guile and morally superior to everyone else. But that's what the article actually begins to lay out. And the argument really is that hate then becomes a license for violence. and that hate actually then begins to be seen as a powerful, as power itself. If I can gen up enough hate, and I can do so in a way that is self-congratulatory and self-righteous, then I can have power over you simply by this, I mean, because hate's powerful. It just is. And so it's interesting that hate then becomes perceived as a moral imperative. So just think about that for just a minute. Instead of love being seen as the moral imperative, instead of gratitude or grace or thankfulness or resilience or cooperation, I mean, whatever positive moral imperative you want to think about, unity, freedom, instead, hate itself becomes the new moral imperative. And people then begin to identify not with a particular source of moral outrage, but simply with being morally outraged. And so what the article is seeking to address, or actually at least identify, if not address, is that we've reached the stage of the game where many on the left have simply arrived at a place of such hate that the only way to answer it is either in kind, which obviously is completely unacceptable from a Christian worldview, or, as I would advocate, that we meet it with people who are full of grace and truth, and that we meet it, we counter it with love. What would it actually look like to love people who hate us? And I think this is worthy of our exploration. As you consider what consumes someone, what fills someone, as you consider the moral language that gets used related to, let's say, evil or the idea of moral superiority, how could a person be morally superior if there is no hierarchy of ideas, if there is no greater good, if there is nothing that is good, better, or best? And who gets to define those things? How could there be a sense of guilelessness, it's a hard word to say, among those who are hating if hate itself is a form of guile? And this idea that hatred gives people a license for violence, I think should be of real moral concern to us as Christians in the culture today. As Christians, we certainly know that we're called to love our enemies. We certainly recognize we're not to demonize anyone with whom we disagree. We recognize the power of ideas to shape other people's minds, to shape our minds, and to lead hearts to action. So where does that leave us at this particular cultural moment in America today? I think that I want to encourage us to consider a question, and it's this. When I'm standing in front of the mirror, when I'm actually like having that face-to-face, difficult conversation with myself about what I'm full of, I think it's a worthy question to ask. Am I hateful? Am I full of hate? Or am I full of grace and truth? Jesus came full of grace and truth. So those who are in Christ and in whom the Spirit of God is pleased to dwell, we likewise should be full of grace and full of truth. When life squeezes us, when there's disagreement around us, when we're pressed hard in from every side, what comes out? Well, it's what we're full of, and everybody's full of something. So I just think that today I want us to consider, before we, you know, sort of cast aspersions on other people and say, well, they're hateful and that's what's just pouring out, that may well be true, but with what am I meeting it? If I'm just meeting hate with more hate, that's not going to work. That's going to lead to the devolution of our culture. And I would like to see us be redemptive. I would like to see us actually embody the kingdom principles, the principles of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And that means that we are going to meet hate with what? With love. We're going to meet hate with grace. We're going to meet lies with truth. So that brings me to one other thing here in today's connecting point. People can actually handle the truth, and they can handle a lot more of the truth than you've been led to believe. So I found this in Science Daily, and it's actually a University of Chicago Booth School of Business research study, and it's new research that explores the consequences of honesty in everyday life. And the study sort of proves out that people can actually afford to be more honest than they think. You can actually tell more of the truth about more things more often than you've been led to believe. People are not as contrary to the truth as maybe we have thought in the past. People significantly overestimate the cost of honest conversation. That's what the study says. The researchers conclude, I'll just read this paragraph. The researchers conclude that such fears, the fear of telling the truth, of being honest in conversation, are often misguided. Honest conversations are far more enjoyable for communicators than they expect them to be, and listeners of honest conversations react less negatively than was expected. And so what they're encouraging people to do is to speak in accordance with your beliefs, thoughts, and feelings, which sounds an awful lot like speaking the truth. Now, you and I recognize we're going to speak the truth in ways that honor Jesus. We're going to speak the truth. We're going to speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. We're going to speak that which accords with reality. That's the truth. And we're going to do so in love. We're not going to speak the truth in hate. We're not going to speak the truth in ways that are vengeful. We're not going to speak the truth in ways that are hateful. We're going to speak the truth in love. And so how do we do that? Well, if you would like some encouragement on how to speak the truth in love, I wrote a book on that called Speak the Truth, How to Bring God Back into Every Conversation. You can find out more about it at my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. The other thing posted, I don't know if we posted. If you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and you sign up for my email newsletter, I only send it out once a week, and I do it on Monday, and it's called the Must Read Monday. And so if you want to get the things that I've been reading over the weekend and that I think that people need to be reading as a look back for last week and a look ahead for this week, you want to grab the Must Read Monday at reconnectwithcarmen.com. So one of the things that it talks about in this Science Daily wrap-up of this University of Chicago Booth School of Business research on speaking the truth, that's not the way they call it, people can handle the truth more than you think. I'm going to call it speaking the truth. They set up these experiments, and so I thought maybe I would tell you what these experiments are and then encourage you to do them, or at least do one of them. So in one field experiment, people were instructed to be completely honest with everyone in their lives for 3 days. Maybe you and I could test that. Be completely honest with everyone you encounter under every circumstance, in every situation for the next 3 days. Completely honest. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help us God. In another experiment, participants had to be honest with a close relational partner, so that might have been a friend, that might have been a spouse, that might have been a parent or a child, while they were answering very personal and potentially difficult discussion questions. And then there was a third experiment where participants were instructed to honestly share negative feedback to a close relational partner. So those might be a little bit harder because those are like lab experiments, but the first one is a field experiment. And that means that everywhere we go, wherever we are, in everything that we do, we are going to be completely honest with everyone in our lives, in every situation, in every moment, on every subject. So to be completely honest with you now, I have a rooster crowing just outside my studio, and I can sure hear him, so I don't know if you can hear him too. If you can, his name is J.T. Cluck. And there he is. All right, friends, it's always a joy to gather here with you. The website for the show can be found at myfaithradio.com. You're going to look for the Connecting Faith page. We post things there for you frequently. And there's all kinds of resources available at myfaithradio.com. And for those of you who want to share today's show with somebody new, you can do that by sharing the Faith Radio app. And you can also invite people to listen streaming online. So you may be listening through one of our live broadcast signals across the country, or you may be listening to the show streaming online anywhere in the world. And we would love to hear from you. So give us your feedback. You can do that via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can do that on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. And you can always text us at 877-933-2484. We have a really great week lined up here on Connecting Faith. I'm going to be talking with Matthew Sorens again about the situation related to refugees and immigrants, new immigrants here to the United States of America, and the challenges that folks are facing.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.